Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Pamela Painter. Pamela Painter is the author of the award-winning story collection Getting to Know the Weather, and co-author with Anne Bernays of What If. She has received awards and fellowships from the Illinois and Massachusetts Art Councils and the NEA, and is a founding editor of Story Quarterly. She has also received 3 Pushcart Prizes. She lives in Boston, where she teaches writing in the MFA program at Emerson College. Hi, Pam. Welcome to Prosody.
Hello.
How about we start off tonight with you reading a little bit?
I'd be delighted to. Actually, this is a story, since you really have such a wonderful focus on writing, this is a story that I think writers will recognize. It's, you know, maybe stealing stories. Okay, should I just go?
Absolutely. Okay.
The story is called Custody. The divorce lawyer tells me no problem. He doesn't mean there is no problem with my marriage, and therefore I should stay married. He is smarter than that. He devotes the first 5 minutes of my appointment to letting me know how smart he is. He tells me he doesn't take on a woman client who wears a hat. Hats are trouble. That's how smart he is. I do not ordinarily trust men so concerned with surface things, but he comes highly recommended. But moments before, on the sidewalk just yards from his office, I lost my hat. It sailed across the avenue, and I had to make a quick decision. How important is a hat? I let it go. Should I tell him now? Instead, we get down to particulars. I tell him my husband is a writer, and we have been married 2 years. There are no children. See what I mean, the lawyer says. No children, no problems with custody or visitation or child support, no messy false claims of child abuse. He says in terms of grounds, child abuse has replaced adultery. What we have to deal with here are assets, he says. He makes assets sound like a part of my anatomy. Make a list, he says. You know, the house, the car. He has a lined legal pad in front of him on his desk. I am momentarily distracted to see a legal pad used for something legal. So, what are the assets in question, he says. And I tell him the house, the cars. He breathes deeply, as if gratifyingly dismayed that a writer with such a major minor reputation as my husband should have so few material possessions. It's simple, he says. You add the house, the car, your car, and divide by 2. He openly looks at his watch. Well, I tell him, it's not so simple. It's about my life, our lives. I include my husband's life to appear fair, though I don't envision it an asset. I tell the lawyer the last straw occurred 2 weeks ago. That's when I learned my husband wrote a story about the abortion I had when I was 14 and published it in a prestigious journal that doesn't appear on newsstands. I explain how my husband read it at a reading before I knew it existed, and that I could tell by his guilty look as he left the podium that he knew what he'd done. What he'd done, the lawyer says? In public, I say. He'd done it the same way a man might take a woman to a restaurant to break up with her and thereby avoid a scene involving her no longer seductive removal of clothes or her vengeful use of kitchen scissors. The lawyer doodles to avoid a reply. I say my husband was hoping to dazzle me with his images, his sensitive characterizations, his solicitous dedication, when all along he knew I was saving up the abortion story for when I write stories of my own one day. Besides, I say, he wasn't the father. And since then, I've found his notes for a story about the humane method my mother used to kill farm cats, a draft of a story about living in a house, my farmhouse, with not a single door, lists of my uncles and cousins' names. The lawyer isn't following this. I remember my hat. I might have saved us both trouble if I'd run after that hat and come here with it planted on my head. Put yourself in my place, I say. Try to put yourself in my place. At 14, the lawyer says, risking eye contact, okay, I'm pregnant at 14. No, now, I say. You're pregnant, the lawyer asks, his eyes skimming my waist. No, I'm not pregnant, I say. It is amazing that dumb men can make you feel as vulnerable as smart men. I tell him, put yourself in my place. I say, pretend you are an aspiring writer. Okay, I'm an aspiring writer, the lawyer says, leaning back in his chair, as if thanking the Lord he is not. I'm an aspiring writer, he says, and I'm pregnant. I sigh. Let's start over. He turns the page on his legal pad. Now, I say, let's say you had a drug problem at 14. I must have hit home because he looks uncomfortable and snaps to an upright posture. Say you had a drug problem at 14 and now you're 45. I give him the benefit of 5 years. You've kicked the drug problem, I say. You write stories. Your wife writes stories. And one day she writes your story. It gets published in Esquire, the story of you at 14 with a drug problem. I get it, the lawyer says. But where does that leave us, or rather you? I don't see libel here. I don't see malicious intent. He's stealing my life, I say. Don't you see? He's using something that belongs to me. After all, it's my material. Assets would be your word. It's not exactly the family silver, the lawyer says. Exactly, I say, leaning forward. It's much more valuable. Listen to this. I was born in the South. I learned to read in our outhouse from a Sears catalog. A mall was built across the road from our pig farm. I was one of the first people in this country to see a mall. My mother worked at Kmart till 7-Eleven bought out the pig farm. When I was 13, we moved to New York City, where my father abandoned us for Seagram's Seven Crown and the counter girl, a chock full of nuts. There's more, I say. I was the oldest of seven brothers and sisters named Moe, Fajine, Fester, Wilmer, and Quinn. My twin sister was Star, and I was Starlight. She and I used to take the subway to Greenwich Village and shoot up while wearing fingerless black wool gloves. I tell him I know death. Star was buried in those gloves. The lawyer is listening now. I tell him an English teacher took an interest in me and taught me everything he knew in the high school supply room. He took credit for my SAT scores and my scholarship to Radcliffe, and I gave him credit for my first sexually transmitted disease. I describe one of my brothers who is doing time for armed robbery and another brother who holds a chair at MIT and communicates only by computer. I tell him how I hit Europe so hard I skipped over it and landed in India. I tell him I've been a cab driver in Israel and a nun in Burma. I omit that my first husband was a count because Americans, especially lawyers, are so impressionable. I tell him I met my current husband on a tramp steamer out of Australia. It was the calmest 2 months of my life, and my husband later admitted his most exciting. I say this should have been a clue. I lie to the lawyer a little, tone things down. Most lawyers have unfinished novels in their bottom drawers. So he knows all this, the lawyer says. Most of it. You don't know someone until you know all about them, I say. It comes after, you show me yours and I'll show you mine. Whatever happened to imagination, the lawyer asks. I shrug and treat it as a rhetorical question. So tell your husband to stick to his own life. I tell him about my husband's life. I describe the intact, happy marriage of his parents named Fred and Norma, his sister Jennifer and brother John, teacher and daughter respectively, the dog Macduff, Sam the cat, the Midwestern schools from kindergarten to Ohio, band practice, debate team, student government. I say Lord knows why he became a writer. I say I suspect my husband of marrying me for my life, and now he thinks he owns it. So you want a divorce, the lawyer says. I need protection, I say. When my husband and I first met, he'd say, more, more, tell me more. Sooner or later, he'll know everything. I tell the lawyer I've had it. I tell him I want custody. I want it all back. My life.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Pamela Painter. Pam, I want to ask you a little bit about the way you bring your characters to life. One of the things I notice is, you know, in other stories from other writers that I've read, a lot of times they might spend a lot on physical description, you know, kind of slipping it in here and there, how tall they were, what color their hair is or something like that. And with you, we get a detail or two. You know, it's mainly something that's caught actually the character's attention more so than I think like trying to convey it to the reader. And it makes, you know, kind of in the way I was reading your stories, we have to listen more carefully to your characters than just kind of look for them in the stories. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you bring your characters to life.
Ooh, okay, how I bring my characters to life. First of all, it really depends on how long the story is. I've been writing short shorts recently, 250-word stories. So you can't spend as, say, Cheever would do or Opdyke or Monroe or Atwood, you can't spend a paragraph, your 250 words, just describing a character. So it really depends on the length of the story. Recently, I've been writing stories of, I would say, 20, 27 pages. And then you have the luxury of really relaxing mm-hmm. into the longer sentence, more details about the character. For example, the story I just read, it's very short. You don't know very much about the characters or the way they look. You know, the man thinks he looks younger than he does.
Right.
The woman wore a hat and lost it, but that's about it.
Right. But to me, I can see them, you know, just those mm-hmm. couple details. And also the way that she's kind of revealing the stories of her life that she's trying mm-hmm. to protect.
Right.
In a way, well, not in a way, very definitely makes her more alive to me than if I knew what she looked mm-hmm. like. And yet, you know, there's been a number of times that I know myself being in writing classes, they'll always say, well, you know, but what does she look like? What does he look like? And I just mm-hmm. found it really fascinating in your stories that it's not so much about their physical description. It's just finding a certain something about them to mention that all of a sudden they're yeah. there.
Well, often it's voice too. I mean, in so many stories, absolutely. They have to get the old mirror out. You know, where's the mirror so I can have my character describe themselves? You know, I've had characters look in toasters and, you know, you really are, going by the mirror that, you know, somebody has hanging in an odd place, you know, the closet yeah. with the mirror. Yeah.
The other thing about this story and in a number of your stories is the humor in the stories. And one, just to talk about what it's like to write humor. I think a lot of writers avoid it because they think it's just hard, and particularly how you keep it funny through the revision process. Mm-hmm. Like, how does it stay funny to you too? Does that make sense?
No.
Okay.
I don't know a thing about humor or writing comedy. If I could take a course somewhere, I would. I think it is so hard. I feel like anytime I come up with a funny line, it is a gift from the gods. It is a gift from the gods. And humor, I heard somebody say that irony is the juxtaposition of incongruities. And it seems to me that that is what humor is, a juxtaposition of incongruities. And, I'd love to take a course on it. Maybe the only way to do it is to teach a course, and then I'd have to teach myself. But I really feel that it's...
That's great. You have an innately then.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, like I'm thinking how that detail. She's got the hat. She lost the hat. And then mm-hmm. he's talking... You know, she's reminded of it because he's talking about how he doesn't like women who wear hats. Mm-hmm. And then later on when she's saying, good thing he doesn't know about my hat. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just that's such a natural line and it's a funny line. And I was trying not to laugh because we're on the air and I was trying not to interrupt your story. But, you know, just those places where, you know, I was just curious as you're editing. I mean, do you think about that kind of stuff in terms of or just you're just crafting the story as a whole?
You know, I really don't think about it. I just feel lucky when I get a funny line.
Good for you.
But it also is, I think it's in the details. Again, that's juxtaposition of incongruity, just in the details. The fact that her husband's life is so boring, you know, and some of the things that just come in are, you know, that she and her twin were named Star and Starlight. You know, they just kind of come out of nowhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Pamela Painter. Would you read a little bit more for us?
Sure. Actually, the story I think I'm going to read from, when I'm teaching, I talk about the inside and outside story, and I know there are Ron Carlson, Nancy Zafras, a lot of us think of the stories in that way. And this is a long story, so I'm not going to read the whole story, but I like to think of the story, the outside story, as Ron Carlson would say, the engine that moves the story, that drives the story. So if you're listening, listen for that outside story and then also listen for that little emotional seed that starts to come in. So maybe I'll just read the setup for this story.
Great.
Okay. It's a story called Grief. It takes place in Boston, has a male point of view. Grief. Harris was walking his usual route to work up Beacon Street and past the State House when half a block ahead he saw their stolen car stopped at a red light. It was their missing car, all right, a white 94 Honda Accord, license plate 432DOG, easy to remember. And it was still pumping out pale blue exhaust. Portent, Harris remembered thinking, of a large muffler bill and so much grief. He quickened his pace to get a look at the driver leaning against his door, the driver's fingers drumming impatiently on the wheel as if he had better things to do with his time and Harris's car then wait for the light to turn green. Or maybe the police cruiser idling two cars behind was making him nervous. Harris ran back to the cruiser and rapped sharply on the window passenger side. It scrolled down at a snail's pace. Pointing, Harris told the cop, "See that car ahead? Two cars, the white Honda, that's my car. It was stolen 2 weeks ago. See it? That's my car." As the light turned green, the Honda pulled away with the rest of the morning traffic. Bursts of adrenaline shot through Harris, the first thing he'd felt in the year since his wife's death. The cop looked after Harris's disappearing Honda and then back at Harris as if trying to decide if he was a nut. "Okay, mister, get in," the cop said. And for once, Harris was grateful for the respectable-looking briefcase his wife had given him on their 25th anniversary. Harris yanked on the door handle, but it was locked. "No, in the back," the cop said. "Get in the back." Harris threw his briefcase onto the back seat and slid in behind what was surely a bulletproof window between him and the cop, taxi style. Siren blaring, they crept down Beacon Street in a low-speed chase and swung right on Tremont. Cars parted for them reluctantly, giving up feet, not yards. 30 seconds later, they were bumper-to-bumper with Harris's stolen car, and the cop was strongly suggesting on his loudspeaker that the driver pull over. Harris was sitting forward, his nose inches from the scratched plastic divider. "That's it. That's my car," he said. "You wait here," the cop said, as if Harris had foolishly been planning to accompany him on the dangerous stroll to the stolen car. Unbidden images came to Harris's mind. He pictured a stash of cocaine or a weighty little handgun the new owner had tucked under the driver's seat or hidden among the maps of New England. If the thief had noticed all the hiking guides, he probably wondered why Harris even needed a car. Now the cop was standing outside Harris's car, legs spread in cop stance, no doubt asking to see the driver's license and registration. Good luck. The registration was in the glove compartment where it belonged, but hidden, his wife's idea, inside a paperback mystery involving root vegetables. The cop car's siren and flashing lights had drawn a business-suited crowd, which gathered at a safe distance from any anticipated mayhem. Knowing Boston, Harris had never hoped to get their car back and still roadworthy. He had merely expected to come home to some message from the police on his answering machine saying they'd found his car trashed and wired on the campus of Tufts or MIT or abandoned in a bad part of town. The day after his wife died, Harris had driven an hour west on I-90 until he came to a rest stop with an outside phone booth. He had pulled the folding door shut against the outside world and had called home over and over to hear his wife's voice say, "Hello, please leave a message. We don't want to miss anything." Then he'd saved the tape and left a message of his own. "No license on him," the cop said as he dropped into the front seat. "Says he left the registration with his sister because she's trying to sell the car for him." He punched 432-DOG into a black box in the dash. Seconds later, like a fax, maybe it was a fax, out scrolled a sheet of paper with not much written on it, but the cop studied it thoroughly. He verified Harris's name, address, and when he'd reported the car missing. Then once again he told Harris, "Wait here," and approached Harris's stolen car, where he motioned for the driver to get out. The crowd drew back. The driver's Red Sox jacket had a ripped sleeve and his jeans were faded to a pale blue. Short and stocky, he was this side of 40, a limp ponytail hanging off a bald rump of a dome. The cop spun him around and told him to lean against the car. His legs spread apart. Then he patted ponytail down movie style before clamping handcuffs on his wrists. Satisfied, the cop pointed to where Harris sat waiting and gave ponytail a slight nudge toward him. Soon, ponytail was peering in at Harris on one of those fake freeze frames Harris would trust in any movie from that moment on. His gaze was cool, not giving anything away. Real static hissed on the car's radio as the dispatcher asked if the cop wanted backup. "Nah," the cop said through the front window, "I'm bringing him in." Somehow, Harris couldn't picture himself and Ponytail locked in side by side in the back seat of the cruiser. He tried to roll down the window, but it wouldn't budge. The cop nodded for Harris to get out. What else could his nod mean? Harris gathered up his briefcase and waited for the cop to open the door. Harris's peripheral vision assured him that Ponytail and he were not going to do anything rash, like make eye contact a second time. "The car's all yours," the cop said. "Keys are in it." All three of them looked at Harris's car, helping the police cruiser hold up traffic. Their bottleneck was doing a bad job of channeling three lanes of angry drivers into two. "Thanks," Harris said. Then, "You mean I just drive it away?" "Anywhere you want," the cop said. I can't take custody of him and your car at the same time. He's coming with me. I guess that leaves you with a car. His mustache twitched with humor, impatience, and pride. Sure thing, Harris said, something he knew he'd never uttered before in his life. Well, see you around. Feeling a bit ridiculous, Harris took possession of the car. He moved the seat back and adjusted the rear view in time to see Ponytail disappear into cop car land, the cop's hand on the back of Ponytail's neck to make sure his head cleared the door frame. The cop pulled out and around Harris, no siren but his lights still flashing. Slowly, Harris drove back to his apartment and parked in front, in the same spot from which his car had been stolen. For the first time, he assessed its state, then set to gathering up Dunkin' Donuts cups, McDonald's cartons, and candy wrappers, and stuffed them into a white Dunkin' Donuts sack. The paperback mystery, Roots of All Evil, was still in the glove compartment, and just as his wife had predicted, had disguised the registration well. The walking guides and maps were still under the seat. There was no handgun, and when Harris got home after work that night, there was no wife to tell the story to. 3 days later, he was matching socks and watching the TV when the phone rang. He hoped it wasn't the solicitous new tenant from the upstairs apartment, a woman whose roast lamb and braised chicken tempted Harris to emerge from his solitary gloom, a gloom he always returned to well-fed, but even more despondent. She had probably noticed his car in the street and wanted to hear how he'd gotten it back, perhaps help him celebrate. He didn't know how to tell her that more than the car was still missing. When he said hello, he felt instant relief that it was not the woman upstairs, but a man's gravelly voice. "You got my TVs," the voice said. Harris told him he had the wrong number. "No, I don't," the man said. "I want my TVs." Harris hung up and went back to sorting socks. Mostly black, they were draped over the back of the couch side by side, toes pointing down the way his wife used to line them up. Now fewer and fewer of them matched. The phone rang again. It was probably the guy missing his TVs, and Harris thought, let him.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Pamela Painter. So let's talk about inside-outside story a little bit. Mm-hmm. One of the things I notice in your stories beyond these kind of the tension between the kind of what's motivating the story forward on an action level and then kind of, you know, I would say what's more at stake, what's more at risk, that's playing counterpoint to it almost. On the action level, there's things that are evident but also seem kind of strange to me, like the mystery novel with the root vegetables in it, you know.
That's part of the humor. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I could have come up with any title, and there's
that was great.
The root vegetables,
the root of all evil. And there's another one of your stories where it's a hairdresser who's cutting hair, and you know that, but she's cutting it wrong. And you find out in the inner story kind of why that's happening that way. And then, you know, there's the inner story, which, again, it seems to be what's at stake. And so I'm as you're writing this way, are you looking for the breaks and kind of the moments that open up to kind of delve into what's really at risk underneath it all? Do you get the clues for it from the outer story? Is it the inner story you know first? Is it happens at the same time?
Well, I like to think of the inner story as the emotional, you know, traumas we've all had, the emotional lives we lead, you know, betrayal, loss, grief, all those things. So I can hear almost any anecdote and then marry it with an emotional truth. And so, I mean, the story that I just started reading was I heard three lines. Somebody had his car stolen and he got his car back and whoever had stolen it had a whole bunch of TVs in it and he wanted them back. That's all I heard. I had to make everything else up. And so that was sort of the engine that drives the story, the outside right. story. And the grief, it seems to be that it's grief over this muffler bill that he's going to have. But as you read through hear the story, it's how he's unable to come to terms with, you know, the loss of his wife, that grief. But if you think in terms of the outside story and the inside story, what you're able to do as a writer is to take any anecdote and make it into a rich, full story because you can put an emotional truth from anywhere to it. So I think of marrying that, the outside anecdote with the emotional truth, and you just get a story, a full story that way.
Yeah, it seems to, you know, I think a lot of times writers stick themselves in a corner with the what's going to happen next. And it seems like that's almost balancing things too much on the outside story, like the action of it, instead of, you know, really kind of looking at that, like, what are the things that are poking through the inner story that's poking through in these actions that is actually where the I don't know if I want to use like a word like oasis or the fertileness of the story.
Kind the of, heart of the story.
Absolutely.
It's the heart of the story. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I also want to talk to you a little bit about you have very compact language in your stories. I think they have not just your reading style, they have a pace to them. They feel to me like they're not wasting a single word. And so is that something that happens when you're first writing it? Is that something that happens more when you're revising?
I think it's all in the revision process.
Yeah.
Yeah. I write my stories in 1 or 2 days, and then I might revise them for a year or two. And, I mean, one of the things I love is, you know, getting rid of an extra the. And just really caring about language, paring it down, and working very hard. Sometimes I don't know what the story is about until draft 9. And all that time I'm working with language, and it's really language that allows me to figure out that, oh, my God, I'm really writing about this. And I wished I'd hidden that from the reader a little better. Clearly, I'd hidden it from myself for a long time. But then when you realize what you're writing about, you know, it's the language that has delivered that to you, and just taking care with the language.
Yeah.
I
think, and you know, that's something else I noticed as well. I think sometimes when you're reading a story, and if you go back and you read it a second time, you'll kind of see some of the strings on the marionette, mm-hmm. in the sense that something might be surprising to the reader, but then if you go back and read it again, you'll realize that sometimes it's not that surprising to the character that mm-hmm. it's happening to. That's not true with your stories. Your characters, I find, being surprised by things all the time.
Really?
I do.
Huh.
And, you know, that it's not just you kind of pulling the strings like, oh, well, I need, you know, the character to be surprised here. And that sense of the narrator or the author mm-hmm. actually knowing a lot more. And you just said that sometimes things will happen and you'll be like, well, look at that. There mm-hmm. it is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that really comes through in your stories, and was really refreshing, because that's I always get so dissatisfied when I read a story and I can kind of figure out where it's going before it gets there.
Oh, right. Yes. Oh, you don't want to know. And if the writer doesn't know, which I never know when I'm writing a story, then that is more of a surprise for me and the reader. I can see how that would work.
Yeah, it's great. Huh. Well, I want to thank you for coming to Prosody.
My pleasure, entirely.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wade. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP. All the way down. She had a smile that swerved, she had a smile that curved, she had a smile that swerved all over the world. It's all wrong.